You're listening to the Illuminaire podcast, where we dive deep into behavioral health topics and shine a bright light on the forces shaping this industry's future, from research and technology to business and investment and more. Here's your host, Dr. Ronit Molko.
Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Ronit Molko, and thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Illuminaire podcast. Today, I'm thrilled to welcome Vanessa Castañeda-Gil to the Illuminaire podcast. Vanessa is an autistic advocate and the CEO and co-founder of Social Cipher, which is a social emotional learning platform that connects neurodivergent youth and their advocates, such as counselors, teachers, mental health professionals, in an immersive virtual world. It's Vanessa's mission to unite her passions for art and stories in innovative ways that help people. Vanessa and her team have earned recognition as Forbes 30 Under 30s, AT&T Aspire and Camelback Venture Fellows, and Facebook Global Gaming Citizens. Vanessa, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
It's so good to have you here. Let's start off with talking about women and autism because, you know, it's such a big topic now. At least it's becoming a bigger topic, getting a lot more attention, which is great. And we know that women are often completely missed in terms of diagnosis of autism or misdiagnosed with other things such as anxiety disorders, eating disorders, OCD. Share with us a little bit about your journey, how you were identified and got the right diagnosis and kind of what your journey has been like as a woman.
Sure. So I'm really glad that the topic of women and girls who are autistic is finally starting to come up more and more because it is an issue that definitely needs to be addressed and needs more attention. But when it comes to my story, I had a very, difficult time when it came to my diagnosis, figuring out what I had and what was going on with me. And I had been diagnosed with a whole bunch of different things. And it took a while and it took, some mismedication at times and a couple of different psychiatrists, which was really difficult. And a lot of the time I got feedback of, oh, well, you have friends or, oh, well, you have good grades. So you must, you must not be autistic or you must not have ADHD because I have both. And that was a really difficult thing to get over. And I think also one thing that was very difficult for me that caused a lot of shame in my diagnosis for a while was that there was representation of autism, but number one, a lot of the time it was negative. And number two, it was typically a middle-class white male. And that's who I had to relate to. And for a while, I just thought that, oh, I'm supposed to be, this cold and calculating genius robot with the personality of a boy, apparently. And
right,
that's really all I had to relate to. And so for a while, I just, thought that I shouldn't have emotion, that I wasn't capable of connecting with other people, and that I should just be like, all the autistic boys I would see on TV. And it really distanced me from myself and what it meant to be a woman of my own definitions, and especially what it meant to be an autistic woman. I mean, I didn't meet another autistic woman until I was 20 years old. And I really just had no representation out there. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done. I think for a long while, I felt a lot of social pressures, especially growing up with a lot of other teen girls, and just not feeling like I belonged and feeling like I had to constantly mask and constantly feeling othered. And I think if being an autistic woman and we're more normalized and if there were more representation, which is why we have an autistic protagonist that is a girl, then I would have had a much easier time realizing that I was totally okay the way I was.
Yeah, and there's a big misconception around emotions and empathy, right? There's kind of this misconception out there that autistic individuals don't have feelings and cannot experience empathy. And yet, from what I understand from the people I talk to, it's actually the volume is higher on that, right? The empathy scale is kind of higher. Huge sensitivity, huge empathy, and feeling so much of what other people feel that it can become overwhelming.
Right. It's huge. And I think that especially with autistic girls and women, one thing that happens is because we're so empathetic, because we just want to help, and this is not speaking for everyone, right? But this is definitely my experience, is that because I was a woman. I wanted to help. I wanted to, you know, be nurturing, be there for people. I was taken advantage of a lot, or I was, you know, bullied and had no idea about that, right? Because I had so much empathy for people and I drained myself, you know, trying to help people that may not have even needed or wanted the help or may have had, you know, bad intentions. And that took me a really long time to learn. And that's a lot of why in our game, we focus on self-advocacy, because for years, I mean, women in general have a difficult time with setting boundaries and with being able to say no to things just because of the society that we were unfortunately raised in. And I think as an autistic woman, that's even harder when there are, you know, different levels of empathy where you really need to and feel compelled to help, especially to ingratiate people when you feel othered. And I definitely fell into that. And that's something that for sure needs to change. And we need to be teaching more boundary setting, more self-advocacy skills to especially autistic women and girls.
Yeah, because the statistics around being prone to abuse, right? Being prone to, you know, sexual assault, being prone to just, you know, all of that is higher in the autistic population in general and higher in women. So tell me what led you to develop Social Cypher. Well, first tell us what it is and then what led you to develop it.
Sure. So Social Cypher is a game-based social emotional learning platform for neurodivergent youth and the professionals who work with them. And we create social emotional skill building in a safe environment for neurodivergent youth to practice and understand social emotional skills in their own way. And we do that through Space Pirate video games. So our game series is called Ava. It follows the adventures of an autistic protagonist whose name is Ava as she goes to the galaxy and recruits different pirates and learns more about building a team. And that weaves in different social emotional competencies. Our first episode really focuses on trust. And that's most of what we do. And the reason that I started this was because of my own experiences as a person and especially as a woman on the spectrum. So I was diagnosed when I was 14 years old, and I had a really, you know, as I mentioned before, I had a really difficult time with stereotypes, really difficult time with finding resources around me, and I thought that I was supposed to be a cold, calculating robot. Just wasn't emotions and connecting to other people. It felt like it wasn't ever in the cards for me, so I just shut it off. And of course, you know, we're humans. We can't shut that off. And so I ended up falling into a depression. I had really terrible mental health issues like anxiety and low self-esteem for years. And I wouldn't tell a soul about my diagnosis for about 6 years. I was so ashamed of it. And it wasn't until I started learning through the things that made sense to me that I started to, you know, build my social emotional competencies and realize that I could connect with people. And for me, I learned about the way that I connected with people through music and movies and games. They were stories that I could latch onto and understand and feel represented by. And so I went to college, I became a neuroscience researcher, I published, and I looked back at how far I had come. And I had made these amazing friends, and I wanted to kind of put two and two together. And so I put my personal experience and my neuroscience research experience together, and that's really how Social Cypher was born. And you know, here we are 3 years later, we've got an amazing team of 9 incredibly talented people. And we've just released our first episode of Ava, along with an entire platform. So not only do we have our game series, but we have curriculum for social emotional learning. And then we have an entire sort of dashboard learning platform that allows people to stream the game remotely with their students and clients.
And so what age range is this designed for?
It's designed for ages 10 to 15, middle school to high school.
And why did you pick that specific age range?
That's a great question. So the reason that we picked that age range was, number one, personally, I had the most difficult time in middle school. That's when, you know, for most people, social interactions get more complex. It's this age of self-determination where you're really trying to figure out your identity and who you are. And it's when bullying gets worse as well. It's when these just intricacies start to arise that you never even expected socially. And we were also seeing in a lot of our research that we had been doing was that a lot of autism technologies or games or anything like this was really geared towards younger children or elementary school age children. And there was nothing for youth. And so we thought that we would really fit in well there. So that's where we are.
And what made you choose a video game as opposed to another type of product?
That's also a great question. So we actually went through a lot. At the very beginning, you know, I was very used to laboratory research. So at first I wanted to make this something where you'd have an EEG net and you have, you know, all these contraptions going on. That was too complex. Went on to doing a VR simulation, but realized that, you know, sensory-wise, the headset could get a little overwhelming, and it really didn't allow us to add actual gameplay into it. And we realized, with the help of, you know, my co-founders, that the gameplay and the engagement and the story was going to be the key to keeping young people interested. Autistic youth are 2 times more likely to play video games compared to neurotypical youth. And I really think that that's for a couple of reasons. One of them is that game qualities, like objective goals and all of these levels and missions, they align so great with autistic traits because we're so goal-oriented and they give us objective kind of goalposts. And I think the other big reason that we wanted to do a game besides the engagement and the traits piece was just that games are such a good place to practice and understand yourself social emotionally without judgment or rejection. You can be a different person, distance yourself just enough to be able to still experience and interact with things, but not do it so directly and in such a high stakes way. So that's really why I wanted to go there.
So it's not as personal. If something doesn't go the way it's planned, it's not.
Exactly.
It's not as personal.
But you still stay immersed in the story, unlike something like a video game, a video or a book or something like that, because it's still you playing.
And so you said the first episode teaches trust. What are some of the other elements that you're teaching?
Sure. So we teach a lot of deeper subsets within trust. So there's a lot on perspective taking, building trust with others, knowing whether someone is trustworthy and untrustworthy, and especially with the untrustworthy folks, advocating for yourself and being able to sort of defend yourself and get out of those unhealthy situations. That's a lot of what we focus on in the first episode. There's also some communicating and building trust with people who may have different communication styles to you. We actually first feature a non-speaking character. Their name is Lior, and they're fantastic. And I think it really, along with, you know, having representation of non-speaking characters, which we think is really important, it really allows you to kind of experience communicating with someone that may just communicate very differently. We thought that was important. And then we have another episode that's coming out this fall, and that'll all be about trying new things, which was a huge topic for us. And what we do with our topics is that we co-develop everything with the neurodivergent community. So aside from me being neurodivergent, as well as 40% of our team, we also are constantly playtesting, interviewing, doing focus groups with hundreds of neurodivergent youth and professionals. And we really just, the way that we come up with these topics is we're actually, in all of our interviews and playtests, asking everyone, what do you wish you learned? If you're an autistic adult, for example, what do you wish you learned when you were younger that would have helped you out? Or for professionals, what is the most difficult thing for you to explain or teach to your clients or students? And we take those tallies up, and that's how we create our next episode. So it's really community built.
That's great. I had a conversation with somebody the other day, and he said to me that it's easier to sometimes explain to non-professionals what autism is because professionals have such a preconceived notion based on what they've studied or what they've been taught that they see it through that lens. What's your perspective on how professionals today are viewing autism? Because I think it's changed so much. If I look at myself, right, I learned about autism 35 years ago, and that was a very different model of how we talked about it, how we looked at it. Then today, you know, 30 years ago, we didn't have access to virtually any autistic adults to kind of understand the experience, understand what they were challenged with. Today, we have all these individuals that we can talk to that can say, what are your biggest challenges and what worked for you as a child or a teenager, what didn't? So what's your view on how professionals are viewing autism today, and what do you think needs to change, if anything?
That's a great question. So I would say that professionals are starting to progress in the way that they view that they view autism and autistic individuals. And I think that, you know, has a lot to do, fortunately, with the openness of, you know, autistic adults and neurodivergent folks communicating with these professionals and people being open to it. And I think that's awesome. One thing that I've seen, I haven't been you know, super involved in the autism professional community for, you know, more than I've started my venture. But from my own perspective, I definitely, in the beginning of starting this venture, I definitely thought of my autism as something that needed to be fixed and more of a, you know, behavioral kind of thing. And that led to a lot of self-hatred, a lot of, you know, difficulties with my past self. And in the beginning with Social Cypher, I really was going back and trying to fix my past self and trying to make sure that other kids didn't have to be like me, which was the wrong approach, right? And I learned that after speaking with other neurodivergent individuals and realizing that, no, I had it wrong. If I want to be able to create a change that's lasting, I need to be able to build confidence in neurodivergent young people, starting with myself, right? And that started with me building compassion for my past self and realizing that I was a person that thought and learned differently. I was growing up in a society and a world that wasn't quite built for me and didn't quite know what to do with me yet. And I was doing my best. And that took a really long time to learn. But I think that's something that that professionals especially need to take into consideration when working with neurodivergent youth, especially helping them build that self-confidence and self-love again and helping them realize that being neurodivergent is something that's not going to go away. It's part of you. It's part of your identity. And that isn't a bad thing. It's something that you work with and it's something that you can pull strengths out of and work on. And it has actually some really beautiful parts to it and a beautiful community to it too.
Yeah. And the more we can educate the general population, right, to understand it becomes more about this is who we are as a society. We're made up of all different kinds of people that have all different kinds of abilities and skills and passions and interests. And it's about celebrating the whole, right? Not making one right and one wrong.
Exactly.
I wanted to ask you about friendships because it's one of the questions I get the most from adults that I talk to is just how much they're struggling with friendships. And one of the biggest, the feedback they give is that a lot of them went to social skills programs. Mm-hmm. And it just doesn't work. The things that they were taught just don't work because you're taught to initiate a conversation or you're taught to break into a conversation and it's just not working because the rest of society isn't following the rules and kind of the script that they were given in their social skills group. So how do you, through the video game, help with developing friendships and initiating those social interactions?
Right. So this was definitely something that we saw in our research as the reason why a lot of social skills groups or previous social skills, you know, apps and games weren't quite working. They weren't creating, you know, more applicable skills. They weren't generalizing. And we realized that it's less about social skills and more about social emotional learning. And this was something that I kind of had to life hack for myself, right? Because I would read books on social skills. I would watch YouTube videos. I did all this stuff to learn. But really what helped me was watching movies and seeing how people interacted there and finding what I was passionate about and connecting with people based on that. And I think that the most important lesson that I learned was that not all people are going to be your people. And that is so perfectly okay. And it's actually better, right? And I think that for a while, I tried to compensate for the time where I wasn't really connecting with anyone by trying to connect with everyone and by, you know, making sure everyone liked me and that I was pleasing everyone. And that, you know, that led to its own set of problems, right? Where I wasn't happy because I wasn't connecting with these people. I was just trying to appease them and make sure they were my friends.
So it's just exhausting, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's a lot of work.
I wasn't being myself, right? And I think that through the game, a lot of what we do is in social emotional learning is more internal skill building, right? So a lot of this episode on trust is about what does trust mean to you? What do these friendships mean to you? What do you value in another person? And being able to store that information in whatever, you know, your brain, a binder, whatever you find fit, and being able to constantly retrieve that information when you're in conversation. So, you know, when you're talking to a person, it's less about do they like me? Do they like me? Am I performing right? Am I doing this eye contact and all of these right? And less, and it's more about, do I trust this person? Is this a person I can see trusting? Does this person trust me? Do we have things in common and feel like we're on the same wavelength? And kind of teaching you that not everyone is going to be for you. And that's a lot of this game, right? It's, yes, it's about recruiting pirates, but more than that, you know, we have pirates in the game that are more designed to be well-adjusted pirates for your team. And then pirates that aren't super great, that may not be a good fit. And in our game, it's all about choice. There's no right or wrong answer. If you do make an answer that you don't like, you can make up for it, just like you do in real life, and apologize and, you know, go move on to another subject. But it really is all about choice. So you can recruit or not recruit whoever you want. It's really about who you feel is right for you and who you feel that you connect with. So that's a lot of what we focus on, is those internal skills.
Amazing. I mean, it's a great leap from where we've been. So that's fantastic. What are the biggest lessons you've learned as a neurodivergent entrepreneur?
Oh, so many. I think, you know, one of them is the previous one. Like, not everyone is going to be your kind of person. And I used to get angry about it, because as a neurodivergent entrepreneur, things can be super lonely. And because I am autistic myself and I run a company for autistic people, I have to disclose that I'm autistic all the time, right? Because why else would I, you know, be running this? And so that can make things difficult, because a lot of people, unfortunately, will still have this older view of autism. And I can see when it doesn't happen super often, thankfully, but with certain professionals, I've seen the treatment change. I've seen, you know, someone's voice heighten and be like, oh, wow, you can communicate so well. Or, you know, you have these patronizing little microaggressions that build up. And at first I used to just get really angry about it and just kind of focus on that so much. And now I've turned it into a point where, you know, I turn it into a place where I can educate someone, and where I can, you know, be a representative of my community and say, hey, you know, number one, your stereotypes are wrong and you shouldn't judge by right. those.
And number two, it's the whole, you don't look autistic, right?
Yes. Oh yeah. All the time.
Yeah.
What's that supposed to look like? Please tell me. Yeah. And it's turned into, you know, a place where I've been able to say, okay, this is a place where I can educate. And also this justifies the need for our product. And this is why I'm doing the work I'm doing, right? And I've been able to move on and realize that, you know, people that think that way and that don't want to be educated on it, even if I try, they're just not my people. And I shouldn't focus on that. And that's led me to really build relationships with wonderful people that are, you know, see my autism the way I see it, as something that is just a part of me, and that, you know, can be pretty dang awesome as well. And that's one lesson I've learned. And then the other one I've learned is definitely to ask for help. I've always been a very independent person, have always tried to do everything on my own. And being the CEO of a startup, you can't do that. You have to depend on your community. You have to depend on other people. And I learned the hard way, after many failures and breakdowns, that asking for help is not a bad thing. It's actually something that you very much should do. And then another thing I've learned is that, you know, I may not be able to do things in the same way that my peers do, right? Like in networking, I can't always work the room as other people do or have small talk. Like I'm at a conference right now and I'm kind of holed up in my Airbnb because that's just the best place for me to prepare right now. I wear a stim ring and I find out and scope out different places within these conferences to have my quiet time to be able to kind of like stim and do what I need to do. And I used to get down on myself a whole lot. So I was like, I've worked so hard to get over these things. Why do I still have trouble? And why do all these other neurotypical people not have trouble with this? I am so jealous and so annoyed. And that's how I used to think. And now I'm just realizing that, you know, they have their own tools and places where they need different accommodations. They need different things to learn and thrive. And I have the same thing. I just do things differently, and that is perfectly okay. I may need more rest, or I may need, you know, to have my camera off for Zoom meetings. That's fine. It's yeah. okay.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. Beautiful insights. Thank you. Yeah. If someone in our audience is looking to build something for neurodivergent people, what insights do you have? What should they keep in mind?
Sure. So I think the biggest insight is if you're building something for neurodivergent people, you better have them on your team. It's really important to have that perspective and to reflect that representation, not only in the product, but in your team as well. You want to make sure that you're building something that neurodivergent people actually want and need. And I think that's incredibly important. And, you know, of course, talk to neurodivergent folks, not just at the beginning when you're just trying to figure out the product, but always. We have cycles where, you know, we're talking to neurodivergent folks outside of our team, at least in development periods, probably monthly, like whether it's testing or interviewing all the time, because things change, needs change. And when you meet or talk with one autistic person, that's just one. And you want to be able to represent that entire community.
Beautiful. Yeah, I think that's so important. And, you know, more and more, as we have more individuals that can represent and that are available, companies should absolutely be accessing that community, right? You should access the community you serve. Well, thank you so much, Vanessa. This has been awesome. I really appreciate you taking time away from your conference to spend with me and share this information. I think what you've developed is fantastic. I love chatting with you, and I just appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you so much. This was a great time. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the Illuminaire podcast with Dr. Renit Mulco. If you like what you heard today, please subscribe, rate, review, and share our show with other listeners. See you next week.